Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Delivering on the returns, increasing our margins.
Ratings go down the toilet if I'm not here.
All I do is simply put the math in my favor.
We agree that Brandon and John do good work.
The reason is simple wrestling economics.
I've been told the Netflix numbers. I've been told the metrics a little bit, probably five different times. I still don't get it.
There were respectable wrestling journalists who needed answers.
Thank you very much, members of the media. I hope you all go to hell.
How about we pop a number right here, right now?
The whole part of the show, man.
It's John Pollock and Brandon Thurston. Welcome to the August 20th edition of Pollock and Thurston. And Brandon, as you do a quick memory game, do you recall what was so significant 4 years ago on this date?
August 20th, 2021, is this when CM Punk returned to professional wrestling?
The First Dance.
Yes. That was his return to professional wrestling, which he had left when he left Ring of Honor.
Correct. Yes. Where he stated that he had to leave. He had to get out. And then a very memorable night at the United Center that they sold out.
He's actually been out of pro wrestling again for another 2 years now.
That's true. Yes. He's been on another hiatus as well. But yes, a very, very significant event, and how all things, just kind of interweave, because what immediately followed CM Punk's return to pro wrestling at the First Dance, it was Brock Lesnar's return at SummerSlam. And here we are all that many years later, and our latest Brock Lesnar return at SummerSlam.
The similarities in life just keep happening. Things that are like other things, they just continue to coincide.
Yeah, with the same characters, yes.
Yes.
On today's show, we are going to be going through a lot of interesting topics, not the least of which, the source of our fine graphics that, I mean, Brandon Thurston, he's been doing a really big flex of late. I want to make it clear, I have no contribution to these graphics. This is all the work of Brandon Thurston that have been outstanding of late. I think this is potential t-shirt material, but I think we'd be walking into a lawsuit if we so chose to.
Yeah, I'm hesitant to put too much attention on it because I don't want to get a cease and desist from Parker Brothers or any other board game organizations. But yes, we will be discussing what monopoly power means today, perhaps.
That's just what it is. I mean, it's an eat what you kill world.
Which is now officially his catchphrase when it comes to our soundboard, or when it comes to profiles on Mark Shapiro.
The Wall Street
himself.
Journal. That was the deck. That was the deck for the Wall Street Journal profile on Mark Shapiro this past week. Are you secretly an editor for the Wall Street Journal?
You know what? If I was, I would disclose such a thing. But I have no connections to a. Joe Palazzolo or anyone over at the Wall Street Journal, who also, did you see news story this morning?
No.
McDonald's is lowering their prices on select combos.
Why would they do that?
I guess people are not buying. I guess there are some McDonald's retailers that have priced certain combos as high as $18. Could you imagine?
I can't imagine going to this is an exclusive from the Wall Street Journal, I see.
Oh, yes. Yeah. This is not just them. They were right at the front of this. This is probably a big story in McDonald's world. To cut combo meal prices after convincing franchisees.
All right. Well, it's tough economic times for people. So, you know, if you're going to get your fast food, maybe you need a discount.
Well, later we are going to talk about WrestleMania attendance, always the source of much consternation among many. We're going to talk about the G1 climax. It is over 19 events. How did this year's tour hold up to past years? And we're going to take a look down the rabbit hole of G1s of the past decade. Triple Mania 33 occurring at Arena Ciudad on Saturday, broadcast on YouTube. What records did they set? What records did they not set? We will go through. We'll do some fact checking. And as well, we will start off with the WWE. And are they intensifying this war with AEW? I know that Nick Khan, he has famously said, "I'm like, we're the leaders in the race. And when you're in the race,
You're blinders.
You don't look sideways.
Like a horse.
You just look straight.
Never focus on a competitor. You've never been known to do that.
No, they're not looking left and right at the pay-per-view options on September 20th. They are not looking
dead.
At pay-per-view, very antiquated, except for this past Saturday when they had to promote UFC 319. But we are going to start off with the latest. So last week, well, we're going to have to take people, get everyone up to speed here. So last week, as we spoke about on the show, Brandon and I had reported that WWE was planning for a premium live event September 20th in Indianapolis, Indiana. Here we are a full week later. They have still not announced this show. So we are now exactly a month out from this event that is going to take place in Indianapolis. Dave Meltzer had further reporting that at least as of his reporting, the match that they were earmarking for the show would be John Cena and Brock Lesnar. So a very big match to attach to this show. Now, another wrinkle to this came courtesy of Mike Johnson at PWInsider.com stating that it is possible that this event would not be broadcast on Peacock, but rather on ESPN as a preview of what is to come when their deal goes into effect in 2026, and would certainly up the ante of this event for WWE's purposes and getting the full promotional muscle behind it of an ESPN, which, of course, this event would be going head up with AEW's All Out pay-per-view that takes place the same night from Toronto. And this is just one of several increasing competitive tactics that we're seeing from WWE, that AEW has sort of been to the side, and it just feels like they are really ramping up on several fronts. We'll get into others, but just on this September 20th itself, it is interesting just to see the fact that this could land on ESPN and the fact that this would not be on Peacock.
Yeah, I guess as you guys discussed on Monday night, it's possible that Peacock just has a requirement as part of the deal with WWE that they get a monthly event, and that maybe this event on September 20th would exceed that contractually obligated PLE that they could potentially offer to ESPN, assuming there's no exclusivity clause or something like that. Mike Johnson does note in his report, and then I reached out as well to ESPN, and they declined to comment about whether or not they would actually be the broadcaster for this event. So there's no confirmation from either side here. There's no announcement yet. There's no announcement on Monday. We'll see if there'll be an announcement on Friday. Maybe at the Clash in Paris event. Maybe they'll do this in short order.
Maybe they'll announce this on SmackDown the night before.
Maybe.
We're coming back in 24 hours with Cena and Lesnar. Get ready.
I did call Gainbridge Fieldhouse. We were
meeting. Oh, yeah. I forgot. I teased this last week, yes. And left everyone.
This is a big payoff.
Yeah.
And now
Brandon got on the phone, and one lucky ticket broker was able to pick up the phone and field Brandon's call.
I was looking for contact information for Gainbridge Fieldhouse. I did find the guest relations phone number. I gave that a call. A very nice woman answered, and she did not. She grew tired of my questions about whether or not there would be a WWE event taking place there at Gainbridge Fieldhouse in Indianapolis on September 20th. I don't think she knew, but I kept her on the phone, I think, one or two questions too long.
No, she didn't want to engage. Did you have to drop the "Do you know who I am?" line?
I forgot to mention that. Yeah, I forgot to tell her. Have you heard of WrestleNomics? I did identify myself as a reporter, though.
This weekend, Forbidden Door will be airing in the afternoon from the O2 Arena in London, England. And then several hours later, you will get NXT Heatwave from Lowell, Massachusetts. So probably not any crossover between the two. But like, are you looking at this as sort of like this September 20th strategy could very well be like, I don't imagine this being an outlier when it comes to these events. It feels like if you are WWE, turning up the temperature and going much more aggressively, and TNA potentially playing a role in this as well when it comes to head-to-head competition.
Yeah, I expect it. I think AEW should expect it for all of their pay-per-view events to be opposed by some sort of WWE event. And we're seeing, I think as we talked about last week, the September 20th show is a big step up in terms of them opposing AEW pay-per-view with a main roster PLE. So they're, if anything, just getting more aggressive with trying to oppose at least the AEW pay-per-views. And I think we're going to talk too about the speculation or rumors that, or reports that TNA is at least considering a move to Wednesday nights.
Yes, Carlos Silva of Anthem Sports was interviewed by John Elba for SI.com. And on the current television rights negotiations, he said the quote, "I think August will be quiet. It usually is in the media." I don't know if this August, particularly of 2025, has been that quiet in the media space. It's been pretty robust. He says that hopefully we'll work through a few things, move the ball forward a little bit in August. And then I think in September, October, as we get to Bound for Glory, that would absolutely be the goal, to try and get it done by then. Or certainly, if it's not done, have it agreed to. Now, on the subject of potential partnerships with A&E or CW, Silva told Elba, "Oh, absolutely," in regards to talking to them. Yeah, all of those and more, where we got to navigate all of these properties that have other properties. And where are they all in their renewals? I mean, it's a chessboard, puzzle pieces, and media rights when you're doing these deals. And so it's about timing. It's about who's coming, who's going, and where the slots are. And certainly our job, and I think we did it in such a big way at Slammiversary, is to keep putting out a great product and create buzz. If it creates buzz, then properties are going to want you. Now, in a further report by John Elba, he had reached out regarding the potential of Impact Wrestling being moved to a Wednesday night slot that would go head to head with Dynamite. And in Elba's reporting, it was not denied that that could be a potential landing spot for Impact, which, I mean, if you're looking at this larger game at play, it certainly fits into that. And TNA basically representing almost like a surrogate to WWE, it does have its independent ownership. But I mean, even that is certainly being brought up now in further reporting from Dave Meltzer about whether or not WWE has kind of a deal similar to what we saw with a lot of the European groups, that there's a time frame. They would have a right of first refusal, or at least a window of which they could purchase TNA if they wanted to move forward with that option.
Right. There's at least some rumors or speculation that Lorenzo Fertitta would become the owner of TNA, who is, would you call him the founder of UFC? He's no longer involved in UFC, right? He sold
not
out.
Not a founder. Him and his brother came on board in 2001. Yeah.
Right.
And purchased the company from Semaphore Entertainment Group.
Right.
So could we be that far away from Joe Silva booking TNA?
That would be ideal, right? You get Booker of the Year awards again. I think, you know, we could end up seeing TKO acquire TNA, which I think raises antitrust concerns, among other things. Or I think even if just someone who's aligned closely with them, known to be aligned closely with Dana White, for one thing, was in control of one of these companies. That's, you know, pretty clearly the number three company in the U.S., I think that raises a lot of questions about how much power WWE is consolidating in wrestling, in particular to oppose and to compete against AEW. What's the benefit to WWE to put TNA against AEW? It's to hurt AEW, I guess, because is there really anything else that they're gaining? If you hurt, it's going to hurt TNA to go on Wednesday night, right? But it does help TNA to be on, let's say, if they get on CW or A&E, that's a better network to be on than Access TV. And they would probably end up with higher viewership, even with the impact, no pun intended, of going against Dynamite.
Yeah, I mean, in theory, I mean, certainly if they land on CW, I think that's a major upgrade for them. A&E is less of a sure thing, especially with wrestling competition, but I still would view this overall as a net gain for TNA, that is sort of, they have been in their slot for this amount of time. And I think if we look at this strategy throughout the year, it has not been to position WWE opposing AEW. It's been NXT as the opposition, and that has not really, you know, bared the fruit that I think they anticipated. And so we insert a TNA. Again, this is more so a discussion of like AEW is in this lower tier and not this is not WWE necessarily going right after them, at least on a weekly basis. But this pay-per-view on September 20th certainly is our first example of like a big main roster show to oppose AEW. Like just on the pay-per-view front, because TV is separate. Like, if you are AEW, we do have the precedent from All in Texas when Saturday night's main event was added to the schedule. They moved it to the afternoon. They still went against an NXT show, but a lot less competition than a Saturday night's main event.
They want, they're going to have long enough. They want to get Saturday night's main event.
That's right. You know what? We did get what, an hour of overlap.
Those shows were head to head. In the big main event was head to head with Saturday night's main event.
That is true. So there was overlap. If you are looking at September 20th, like, what is your move? If you are AEW, is it, listen, we can't just be bouncing our shows at the whim of WWE's schedule, or is this, listen, this, like, a WWE event on ESPN, like, that is going to hurt their pay-per-view. I don't know how much, but it will have some kind of effect on it. Like, what is the move here? And, like, you need to kind of come up with a strategy if you're AEW, because, again, I don't think this is going to be just an issue to get through in September. I mean, if this is effective, I think that is something to expect moving forward.
I was thinking with Forbidden Door is going to start at 1 p.m. Eastern time because it's in the UK. I think they should consider just having the normal start time for their pay-per-views being around like 3 p.m. Eastern time, because the show's going to go some 5-6 hours. So that way you're ending at a decent hour. And I think it would put WWE in a weird spot about deciding what time to start their shows at. Do you want to start? Are they going to push a main roster PLE to start at that time to run head to head? I think it would put WWE in a more awkward spot in terms of trying to position the strongest competition against the pay-per-view. And I think there's just inherent benefits, regardless of any of that, of starting those pay-per-views at an earlier hour.
Yeah, I don't discount the idea of like, there's certainly a lot more wiggle room when you're just on streaming of when you can start your shows. But to that point, like, the thought always was with pay-per-view that would have more of an effect. And it really, like, we have not seen any, you know, concrete evidence that it's hurt any of AEW's pay-per-views, like All in Texas. Will some of their smaller shows, does that matter, the start time? To your point, I think, like, it could almost be a benefit when you have these lengthier shows and an afternoon start time is a lot easier for people rather than shows that are going to midnight on.
I would think about more so the end time than the start time, right? Would you rather have a show that ends at like 12:30 at night, or would you rather have a show that ends at like 9:30 at night?
I want to read you this this one excerpt from the Observer last week. This is in regards to the whole TNA situation with WWE. And this is Dave Meltzer's reporting. The idea is that anyone who buys, that being TNA, would do so with the idea of being friendly with WWE, not with the idea of being an enemy. And that if they can get a media rights deal, the company goes from a money loser to a turnkey profitable company. But if they aren't friendly to WWE, they aren't getting the company. A key is this also is to WWE's benefit not to buy, because that's likely why Philippe was a big part of the AAA deal. TKO just went through a major lawsuit. Having a monopsony was a huge part of it, and it cost them $375 million so far and will likely cost more with three other suits ongoing. So, I mean, you read that, and I mean, it certainly does bring up the question here, and it's something for AEW to assess and for others as well to look at. Like, what is the line between just aggressive business tactics and like antitrust concerns when you are, you know, what constitutes like predatory business practices? I mean, head-to-head shows, whether it's like, we don't know if any of these new deals have any exclusivity clauses written into them.
Yeah.
Because that was, and you are coming off the MLW precedent where it was at least enough that TKO wrote a check to make that lawsuit go away over antitrust concerns.
Yeah, I think there's a number of factors here. Now, I'm sure, Lord knows TKO has a legal team that I'm sure is highly aware of antitrust concerns, given UFC's issues, given WWE's lesser but still having issues with the MLW lawsuit that did cost them $20 million to settle at the end of 2023. I think there's, I don't think that the head-to-head competition, you know, targeting WWE's biggest shows and putting WWE content against it is necessary. It's definitely not like illegal conduct.
We do want to talk a little bit about the MLW suit, which, again, that was settled And it was later revealed to be a $20 million settlement that TKO agreed to. MLW had alleged that the WWE violated the Sherman Antitrust Act with MLW's allegations, including accusing WWE of interfering in two media rights deals, one with Tubi and with Tubi, Vice, and then Reels as well. As Brandon rejoins us, and we are revisiting the MLW.
Who could forget Reels? Reels is probably still out there. Am I sounding better now?
Crystal clear. Clear as the difference between a monopoly and a monopsony are to everyone out there.
Now, monopsony, as I understand it, is when you're trying to, for in this case, would be, I'm WWE and I'm trying to keep everybody away from talent, maybe even staff, and I want them all for myself and keeping you away from signing wrestlers. And that's where Tony Khan's allusions to talent contract tampering would come in. But the factors that I think are significant for a potential claim of antitrust by perhaps AEW against WWE is you look at the diversity of partners that they have, not only WWE, but if you're looking at the entire company of TKO and you bring in UFC, you can look at the partnership that they have with Paramount. But aside from that, they have deals with NBC Universal / Versant.
Versant, which is
not a prescription drug, but is a media company that's being split off from NBC Universal, as well as ESPN, Disney, Netflix, Tubi, where Evolve is a Fox property, A&E, CW, which is owned by Nexstar. There's very few media companies that leaves on the table. WBD is one, which AEW, of course, has a deal with. There's Amazon, which AEW has a pay-per-view deal with, at least. But it just sort of closes in the number of options that a potential competitor who wanted to strongly compete in the market with WWE could make. And you combine that with the fact that WBD, like NBC Universal, is splitting off. Here's the good assets, here's the bad assets, and they're going to put all the cool comic book studios along with HBO into one bucket that David Zaslav will oversee, and then Gunnar Weidenfels, who's the CFO, is going to oversee the old cable assets, which will include TNT and TBS. So, and they're doing that because they realize that in the declining cable industry, it's really important to try to consolidate these assets. So you could see before the end of AEW's TV deal, when it ends in 2028 or 2029, you know, the parent company of TBS and TNT could be consolidated into the parent company, let's say, of USA Network or the parent company of CBS, of Paramount. That's all very possible. And I don't know, again, we don't know what those contracts contain, if there's any exclusivity clause. But even if there's not an exclusivity clause, I think a plaintiff could make a case that your partnerships with such a variety of media companies is closing in the market, and it's foreclosing our opportunities to make TV deals with anybody else. Meanwhile, your ticket prices have become higher than ever, and that's disadvantaging the consumer and not providing strong alternatives, which is a great business story for you to tell about how hot your business is, but it's a point in the favor of one that's making an antitrust case. And you look at the venue agreements that we know, at least in one case, WWE did make with the Alamo Dome in 2023 to foreclose any wrestling event happening. I believe it's something like 90 days before and 60 days after. No wrestling event could happen surrounding the days of the Royal Rumble. We don't know if there are other agreements for other venues, but it raises the question about whether there are more.
And how many examples do we get, Brandon? Like, I don't need to see this in writing, that when a WWE event ends and then within a day or two, that's when AEW can announce that they are going to said venue. I mean, it happens with a certain degree of regularity that certainly there appears to be a period that you cannot promote an event as long as there is an upcoming show and vice versa.
And we know that, at least MLW alleged that WWE tried to interfere with the Ring of Honor / New Japan Madison Square Garden show. We according to Tony Khan, he said he had not experienced it firsthand, but that he had heard secondhand from people within AEW that supposedly WWE had interfered and tried to get in touch with some of their own talent who was under contract, and that led to, according to Tony Khan, it led to legal officer Mega Parrick sending an email to WWE to tell them to knock it off. So that, you combine that with, and now WWE has acquired AAA, which doesn't necessarily pertain to the United States. That mainly pertains to Mexico. But it's certainly true that there are a number of Spanish language TV networks in the United States, and you could include that into a narrative that WWE is trying to foreclose the TV market by getting a property that will help them further foreclose the US TV market by getting a property that's predominantly in Spanish language. And you look at what they're doing with TNA, whether or not they actually acquire it, whether or not their friend Lorenzo Fertitta acquires it, it all becomes part of a case of WWE trying to aggressively foreclose competition.
I thought this was a meaningful excerpt that the Hollywood Reporter, when they were reporting on this WWE MLW deal, just kind of broke down here. Under antitrust laws, there must be proof that a company engaged in anti-competitive conduct, since the mere possession of monopoly power is not illegal, and not all aggressive business conduct is considered illegal either. And they cite a case in the FTC's antitrust suit against Qualcomm. A federal appeals court concluded that the chipmaker's actions were simply a profit-maximizing policy. Courts have generally found violations of antitrust law in circumstances where deals have a substantial effect in preventing rivals from entering the market, which at this time they were arguing could be in part of MLW's argument back when this case was in the process. But you look at another aspect to this entire thing, and I think we can certainly look at AEW being this, target of WWE's. And in another sense, like, take AEW out of the marketplace. And how does that color your interpretation of the market at that point, if there was not an AEW in this market space, and how much market share WWE would control? And I mean, like, to me, like, AEW serves a function, if you are WWE, against any of these, like, antitrust concerns.
And if I could head off what some people may be thinking, like, how can you say that WWE has a monopoly when AEW exists? AEW has a big TV deal, and they're on TV, national TV, twice a week. How can you say that there's a monopoly? And if we're thinking about the word monopoly, just mean that you entirely control the market, yes, WWE does not have a monopoly. But that is a different thing from saying they're violating the Sherman Antitrust Act or the Clayton Act or something like that, where you're doing things that that violate those laws that are supposed to protect competition. So it's entirely possible that WWE could have monopoly power. And in fact, that is what MLW alleged. And they could be causing antitrust damage, injury to companies, including AEW. And I think the MLW lawsuit's existence just creates a lot of precedent. And, you know, it makes the case that was viable enough to overcome a motion to dismiss. It defines what the market is, and a judge agreed that that is a plausible market. The judge did not decide on whether or not WWE actually violated antitrust laws, but did decide that that MLW's case was strong enough to continue being litigated, and because it was surviving, it got settled.
It'll be very interesting, because on Thursday, Tony Khan is holding a call with the media, his usual media call ahead of the pay-per-views, and I think, like, this is a pretty relevant topic, just in terms, like, it has been a very noticeable shift that Tony Khan has taken over this past year, where it has been extremely disengaged from any type of rhetoric toward WWE. Like, you have seen a much
which more, I think, is good. I think it's good. So when Swerve Strickland takes a shot at Booker T or something, I think that's received better than it is when Tony does it. For whatever reasons we can analyze, maybe people don't want to hear it from the son of a billionaire, and maybe it's, you know, Swerve Strickland is a compelling character in television and in life. That is a more effective way, I think, to take shots at WWE. It's let your talent do it in certain choice spots, and it's not helpful when Tony tweets about it or, you know, rants about it.
The last thing on this topic is just because it does kind of dovetail with our discussion about, like, pay-per-view from last week. And one thing we didn't focus on too much is that, you know, one of the very few players left in pay-per-view is AEW at this point. And is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Like, for AEW, especially when you're looking at the fact that these head-to-head, like, at least for September 20th, like, your promise to your audience is typically you're going to get an excellent wrestling pay-per-view. but it does come with a $50 price tag. And that becomes a much tougher sell when you have what's going to be a very large promoted event with a big marquee attraction on top in for WWE that may be right on your cable package on ESPN.
Was Survivor Series 87 a pay-per-view or was that a TV event? I'm thinking of Royal Rumble.
Thinking Rumble was the free special on USA in 1988.
It's Royal Rumble versus Bunkhouse Stampede all over again. Watch this special on TV for free versus why would you pay money for a pay-per-view?
That's the argument. And I think that's going to be very, it's going to be a tough ask for people that I think if you're believing that All in Texas going against Saturday night's main event is going to be the be all end all of your argument that, well, AEW will do just fine against this. I think you're underestimating what this level of like head to head competition could have on any kind of regular basis for fans that are going to be, you know, just incentivized to either stream the AEW pay-per-view after the fact and WWE trying to get your eyes to watch their product first and making AEW the secondary product of the night and one that is not worth your $50.
Yeah, I mean, like targeting pay-per-view is not something that's going to put AEW out of business or greatly diminish their existence in the wrestling business. It's all though part of what you could say is it looks like a pattern of trying to diminish the chances of the AEW getting a strong TV renewal next time. Particularly, as I mentioned before, in a world where the media ecosystem, these media companies are consolidating, and they have to consolidate. I don't know. I'm sure W's not going to answer the question, but it's consistent with a strategy where we're trying to diminish the chances of them getting a strong TV renewal in 2028, 2029. We're going to chip away and try to do what we can to bring down the size of their audience and the success of their events and the positive buzz around their events. And maybe when it's time for them to renew, they'll be lumped in with one of our partners and we can kind of pressure and subtly, hopefully legally, do what we have to do to make sure that they don't get a strong TV renewal, that they're left out in the cold completely.
When we were first looking at this WWE TNA relationship, I mean, a question we kept coming up with was what is WWE buying if it gets TNA? Like, what is the value of actually buying TNA? Has that been answered for you these many months later? Do you see more of a reason that WWE would buy TNA, or is it still to their benefit to just let this thing operate on its own? You're going to hold its hand as it goes to its television rights negotiations, and it's an ally of yours in this fight, but does ownership make any more sense to you now than it did months ago?
As an anti-competitive tool, or that's one thing. As the value that AAA has, both probably as an anti-competitive tool, but also as a place to develop talent or recruit talent, or and foreclose the world in which talent is getting paid, right? So we can better control those talent costs. And I think that's, if I'm just thinking of shareholder interest, the greatest interest in all of the world, you know, you do see in TKO's filings when they talk about WWE's profitability, see them talking about, I don't know if they're using the language talent costs itself, but something that encompasses that. I'd have to look it up. But I'm sure they're bearing a lot of extra cost because they've got another, you know, heavily financed company that they're bidding for talent against. And if they want to bring down those costs, the best way to do that is to make that competitor disappear.
Let's go to the Las Vegas Stadium Authority.
Okay.
Love everything that ends with authority at the end of it. And this is the authority when it comes to WrestleMania attendance from earlier this year in Las Vegas. Two nights. What was discovered, Brandon?
As expected. So this is a government-created entity to oversee Allegiant Stadium, which, of course, is where WrestleMania took place this year. And I had my calendar. I literally had my calendar marked because I knew they were doing their quarterly meeting, and that's where they do certain disclosures. They did this in the past when SummerSlam was at Allegiant Stadium, and they disclosed that here's the attendance. What does attendance mean? We'll get into it, I guess. But here's the attendance for day one and day two of WrestleMania. It was day one, 58,000 538. People love numbers and audio. And Sunday, 60,103 is what they disclosed. How do these numbers compare to the numbers that are out there? Well, they're close. WWE announced slightly bigger numbers by a few thousand. Russell takes estimated numbers that are right in the middle. I don't know if I should say all the numbers, if they'll just go, you know, pass right through people's ears one side and not the other. But
we're looking at a difference in, like, the difference between what the Las Vegas Stadium Authority put out versus the WWE publicized numbers. It's enough in the margin that if you wanted to look at, like, were suites included, I mean, it's not the attendance inflations of the past where it would be we'd be literally talking about like 10,000 in a difference. It's like within like a margin that like this is not any kind of like gross overrepresentation of the show's performance.
The infamous heartbeat count that I reported on a couple of years ago may not have been the strategy here. It is, as you said, it's close enough that I can't say that suites don't just make up for this difference. And I don't know if suites are included in any of these numbers. Well, I can tell you that they're almost certainly not included in the WrestleTix number, which is just an analysis of the seats that are on the map, and suite seating is not on the map.
Could Bret Hart have gotten a seat at this WrestleMania if he had attended?
One would hope. Okay. One would certainly hope. Did we learn much here? We learned that, you know, that WrestleTix, I mean, in terms of the Saturday and the Sunday difference, the Saturday and the Sunday difference across these three sources, the Las Vegas Stadium Authority, WrestleTix, and WWE are pretty consistent. They're about, you know, Sunday was about 2-3% higher in attendance than Saturday. I feel that WrestleTix was pretty accurate. WWE, at least on a relative basis, was pretty accurate if they included suites or not. There were about 60,000 people there each day.
And they also promoted the fact that on the first night, 81% of attendees were from out of town, 84% out of town from night two as well. So, and
that brings in hotel revenue, which is very important to the Las Vegas economy.
Yes, as was noted this week, the AP had a story that tourism in Las Vegas is slumping this summer, it reads, with resorts and convention centers reporting fewer visitors compared to last year, especially from abroad. And some officials are blaming the Trump administration's tariffs and immigration policies for the decline. The city, known for lavish shows, endless buffets, and around-the-clock gambling, welcomed just under 3.1 million tourists in June, an 11% drop compared to the same month in 2024. It goes on to state that the Vegas dip mirrors a national trend. The travel forecasting company Tourism Economics, which in December of 2024 anticipated the U.S. would have nearly 9% more international arrivals this year, revised its annual outlook to predict a 9.4% drop. Some of the steepest declines could be from Canada, the company said. Canada was the largest source of visitors to the U.S. in 2024, with more than 20 million, according to government data. So, what does this have to do with WWE? Well, a lot, because I think like this is a Las Vegas based company at the end of the day, and one that has provided WrestleMania, which is on Easter weekend, we're able to generate these numbers, and then putting New Orleans to the side, carved out another two night WrestleMania for next year. Say nothing of the Canelo Crawford fight that's coming up in just a couple of weeks in Las Vegas at Allegiant Stadium. And maybe the biggest of all, realizing these numbers, they're bringing Worlds Collide to the Cox Pavilion the night before Canelo and Crawford.
Yes. I mean, it maybe informs why WWE was willing to move a WrestleMania location after it was already announced. It raises a question about whether Las Vegas is paying maybe even more than $5 million in a site fee compared to the, that's what we learned that they paid this year for WrestleMania, just in a site fee, not to mention some tax credits that they got. Trying to find out, there are some records requests out to the LVCVA, which is a separate entity from the Las Vegas Stadium Authority. This is the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority. Hoping to learn soon. They've been delaying in response to my records requests, so we'll see what happens.
Buried in this AP story might be the answer to all these inflationary issues. I laughed at this. Just off the strip, there's been no slowdown at the Pinball Museum, which showcases games dating back to the 30s. Manager Jim Arnold said the two-decade-old attraction is recession-proof because it's one of the few places that offers free parking at admission. And in the best quote, quote, "We've decided that our plan is just to ignore inflation and pretend it doesn't exist." Mm-hmm. Perfect. Jim Arnold has this all figured out.
Yes.
That's where I want to go, the Pinball
Museum.
Let's
see if we get Jim on next week.
Yes. All right, so there you go. Let's move on to Triple Mania, which happened this past Saturday in Mexico City. And this was their follow-up show after Worlds Collide back in June. And now with Philippe in the midst of, well, we had a representative from Philippe showing up at the opening ceremony here with Paul Levesque and Shawn Michaels, Nick Khan. I was worried that, you know, maybe they were all supposed to do this photo op, and then at the last minute, the representative for Philippe would have been pulled away and not able to do this photo.
Yes, well, they're all in one place. Maybe they could have done a podcast appearance with us, like we had been promised.
Don't accuse us of being petty. At least I'm not petty at all. But they put out this press release. Triple Mania 33, Mexican Lucha Libre promotion, Triple A's largest annual event, became the most viewed and highest grossing Triple Mania in event history. And this was issued on Monday, stating that the event was watched by more than 4.3 million viewers across WWE and Triple A's YouTube channels in Spanish and English within the first 24 hours, with a peak live concurrent audience of 614,000. They announced an attendance of 19,691, and marking Triple Mania's highest attendance, Triple Mania being the highest attendance for any Lucha show this year, and setting Triple A's all-time gate record. And the event broke records for the highest ever merchandise sales in the company's history as well. So this was immediately fact checked by several.
Not so fast. Yes.
Yes, yes. The Cubs fan bringing some a healthy dose of reality to this press release, noting the fact that back in 2019, Triple Mania had aired on TV Azteca, which had put out its own press release, which were well ahead of these numbers, that reached 4.1 million was the Triple Mania number from this past weekend. That 8.2 million was the figure claimed back in 2019, which was a show that featured Cody Rhodes and Cain Velasquez, among many. Kenny Omega was on that show. The Young Bucks were on that show. And so, yes, this is not the most watched.
And the claim here was that
in history,
the most viewed. So this that Cubs fans information there would contradict that.
Yes. Okay. In terms of gate, I mean, we really don't have the Triple Mania gates to compare. I'm sure the pricing of these tickets were exceptional. So, I mean, that's a potential record that they set for the gate record. But it was also pointed out the fact that the peak audience for the show, it was below what Worlds Collide had back in June as well. So don't know if you read too much into that. Like, it did seem like this did have a fair amount of publicity ahead of it and promotion. Like, I thought this was overall a very successful show for AAA, but certainly feeling like this had the WWE stamp on top of it. You had the signature at the beginning, and, you know, this is the shifting of AAA into a, you know, a WWE presentation of Lucha Libre, or yeah, their view or their vision of Lucha Libre.
Very surreal to see, right? I guess the Worlds Collide was not only the first show of the partnership, but it was also just more heavily promoted, right? It was more, it was in the United States. It was an adjoining to, was it Money in the Bank weekend?
Yep.
Yeah.
The same day.
Right. Right. So I think it just had more WWE promotion, more WWE proximity to it than this one did, which is, you know, Triple Mania is the big AAA show of the year.
They also announced that they're going to Las Vegas on September 12th for the next Worlds Collide event, and they announced this for the pavilion at the Thomas and Mack Center, which is the Cox Pavilion. And this is like a 3,000 seat arena, and it's the night before the Canelo Crawford fight. I'm only surprised that they, like, is this an appropriate sized venue in your estimation, Brandon, or am I thinking like this is, especially for a weekend like that, where you think you would probably get a lot of tourists for a big Canelo fight? I would think that Thomas and Mack is way too big of an arena for AAA. But I would suggest
Google says its capacity is 19,522.
Yeah, that's Thomas and Mack, the actual arena, and then this pavilion is about whatever the set is.
This is a pavilion building. I see.
Like this is 2,500 to 3,000 seats.
Well, there's nothing wrong with making your capacity too small in certain cases. In cases like this, where I think it's sort of a sub brand of the main brand. Let there be scarcity. You know, let it be PWG.
Maybe they're still aiming for a seven figure gate with 3,000 people. That's possible. This is not a ticket selling event. This is about, getting as many eyes on this. I'm sure this will be free again on YouTube, and one that's just making it a kind of piggybacking off of a big boxing fight that is going to be the focus of TKO that weekend.
Do we know what the pavilion capacity is? I'm Googling quickly. I don't know. It's just giving.
It's about 3,000.
3,000. Well, that's fine. I think there's nothing wrong with maybe it's experimenting with the idea of creating scarcity and creating this small, condensed, really enthusiastic crowd, and that makes that brand even more exciting. Maybe that works out for them.
The G1 Climax wrapped up this past weekend. 19 shows over the past month, and I will take everyone behind the curtain Monday. I went to go tabulate all the attendances for the past G1.
Did I
calculate it at all? Brandon scooped me because I was going to look up last year's attendance, and boom, Brandon Thurston's story pops up at the top. It's like, man, this guy's just on top of things, and he had the 10 years right there. So it's like you can't compete with Brandon when it comes to.
I've been working on this Python script in preparation for the conclusion of the G1 Climax for days, maybe even weeks.
Beautiful Brandon Thurston chart that I would not have had. And this really does kind of tell the story of the G1 post pandemic and in a kind of post AEW industry for New Japan that has definitely, lessened the importance of this event. And,
should New Japan sue AEW for antitrust?
Maybe that's their next move. Maybe if the Continental Classic is scheduled for July through August of next year. So if you look at this figure, like this tournament peaked in 2019, where over the course of 18 shows, they drew 92,345 people over those 18 shows, an average of 5,100 per event. That number was down to 43,078 over 19 shows for this year's tournament. Like they have never recovered from where the pandemic took this down, and they have lost several of their major stars over the last couple of years, whether it be Okada, Ospreay, Naito. They're going to lose Tanahashi, but I mean, at the end of the day, like it's a cold product at the moment, and I think that was the general sentiment of people that watched the tournament this year. There was some great wrestling, but they don't have that star that is going to make a big difference here. And I think this
attendance. Who won this tournament? Which New Japan star won this tournament?
This was a AEW/DDT/ New Japan contracted performer, Konosuke Takeshita.
Okay. But not like Yota Tsuji or one of their up and coming young stars that are, completely their own.
No.
I think, for one thing, it highlights what a peak and maybe, really what a golden era reinforces to me, what a golden era that the late 2010s was for New Japan. By the way, how credible is this information? I know there are, when it comes to looking at attendances, particularly from Japan, that get published all the time, there's a lot of announced attendances in the mix, but not in this case. So we're looking at only the 2015 to forward data, which
I'm not looking at this year's G1, and my question being, I wonder if this is reliable data from New Japan. Right.
It's pretty low. it's down for the third consecutive year, and it's lower than it was in 2022. You would know better than me too. Was 2022 also impacted by limited capacities at that point? Because I know Japan, kept restrictions in place a lot longer than the U.S. did.
I feel 2022 was a. They were operating at full capacity by then. I'd have to double check that, but I'm pretty sure we were out of the restrictions.
In any case, it's down, in half. more than half, about in half from the peak of 2019. And it's a cool product, apparently. That's what people are saying.
Yeah, I mean, this year's tournament, like, I think the most alarming one was they ran back-to-back nights at Oda Ward Gymnasium, which is, you know, right there in the middle of Tokyo. It's where New Japan held its first ever event. And they drew 1,300 for that first night. And that's just a ridiculously low number to be drawing at that arena for the G1. And, I mean, they did get more in the building the next night. But that was a particularly bad attendance figure. But I mean, overall, like, you just look at this, it only confirms, I think, a lot of the complaints people have had about New Japan. And for this being the big tour of the year, like, it does show you about just how much this audience has been eroded over these past number of years. And I think you can look at many different factors impacting
just mathematically New Japan. Speaking just mathematically speaking, this is always a nice comparison to make, because it's about the same number of shows, with the exception of when they moved it during the pandemic. This is, it's usually the same part of the year. They don't always go to the same towns, but there's a lot of overlap. It's 19 or 20 shows. And so there's this, so the average, so the total as well as the average is meaningful to compare. And I did look at the cage match ratings for the matches, you know, how many matches were over an 8 out of 10 rating. And it's pretty consistent with the attendance, actually, in terms of the match quality was received the best in the best years of attendance and declined thereafter.
And you also looked at how Japanese wrestling companies have compared over the past year. And what did you find among the various companies? Like, who is up, who is down when it comes to Japanese pro wrestling, which is a lot less argument for antitrust practices when you have this many offices in varying degrees of full-time operations.
Right. So we have New Japan, of course, is still number one, which should surprise nobody who's paying much attention to the Japanese wrestling business. And what I tried to do was, so we have, by the way, I pulled all this information from Cage Match, but I believe, you know, by way of this originally comes from the companies themselves. So we should preface this with, there's various degrees of honesty that we believe that are in these numbers, right? So I think New Japan and Stardom, because they're owned by publicly traded companies, are fairly honest. I'm not sure about DDT or NOAH, which are owned ultimately by publicly traded companies, also in the form of Cyber Agent. But I do believe that, say, Dragon Gate is exaggerating their attendance more than New Japan, for instance. But let's just keep that in mind. But okay, let's look at the numbers. And what we find is, yes, it's still New Japan is still by far number one. They're more or less doubling everybody else in terms of average attendance. In terms of total attendance, we've got almost a complete data set in the events where we did not have a data figure. I just plugged in the median to try to get an idea of what the total was. The timeline for this, by the way, is the trailing 365 days. And what we find is, you know, the number two in terms of total attendance, according to their announced attendances, is Dragon Gate. About half of what, just over half of what New Japan is, with 35,000. In terms of average attendance, though, if we sort by average attendance, then we see that it looks like All Japan, according to their announced attendances, is number two at 788, followed by DDT, followed by Stardom, followed by NOAH, followed by Dragon Gate. And then we've got a few more that I included here because we had enough data for them, which are Marigold, Big Japan, Ice Ribbon, everybody's wondering about JTO, Just Tap Out, and of course, Active Advance Pro Wrestling.
Yeah, which I have to catch up on.
Just over 100 fans per event, yes.
And this is only a slice of them. I mean, we could probably go into some, like,
we could do more, but most of their events do not have, either they're not running 20 events, or we don't have at least 50% of their events having attendance data to go along with them.
Yeah. So, I mean, it really does go to show you, like, the impact that a New Japan, like, still has, even with this, like, diminished
decline. Yeah.
Even in this decline, like, it is a very significant percentage of the market that New Japan still commands as, like, the top wrestling brand in that particular country as well. But yes, they will now head into their destruction, or their Road to Destruction tour. And
no, they won't.
Maybe it's a perfectly named tour coming off of the performance in the G1, the Road to Destruction. It's been paved for years by Ghetto.
Yes.
Ohio awarded $46 million in tax credits, and the pro wrestling company is receiving several of these millions from the Golden Trough. We have this listing in Cleveland.com that professional wrestling promotions AEW and WWE secured $2.1 million and $1.1 million, respectively, for their live events in Cleveland. And it states that the Ohio Motion Picture Tax Credit was established in 2009, and the program reimburses productions for 30% of their in-state spending. Awards are made twice a year with a cap of $50 million in credits annually. So this covers just 2025 and 2026, correct?
It sounds to me like this is retroactive.
Oh, it is retroactive.
For events that have already happened, right? It's notable that AEW is getting more than WWE. I imagine it's just related to the volume of events that they did in the state.
Yeah, they did, just like a quick look here, they did a Dynamite and Collision on back-to-back nights in January in Cincinnati, and then held Dynamite in Cleveland earlier this month, while Raw, they did, WWE did Raw back in February. They did a back-to-back with Raw and NXT in February, a Raw in Columbus on June 23rd, and SmackDown last month in Cincinnati, I believe.
Are you doing this all off the top of your head?
No, I have this written, and I just can't read my own writing here because I type way too fast. Okay. But there you have
it. So this would not include like the SummerSlam that WWE did in Cleveland.
Yeah, that's what I was getting to. I mean, SummerSlam was there last year.
I think that would reflect a pretty big tax credit.
Yeah, but I mean, this is not like an insignificant amount that like AEW's getting for like TVs, for instance, just going there. Like they've done no pay-per-views in Ohio over the past year. This is just for running your rank and file Dynamite collisions, and they qualified for, you know, $2 million.
Mm. Yeah,
game changing. All right, some ratings notes for everybody here. Were there any other topics that we skimmed past?
I think we have done all the topics so far, and now we can talk about ratings.
All right, our favorite topic, SmackDown, was number one for the night on Friday night, as they were up against a slew of competitors. But this was their lowest figure in the 18 to 49 demo of the past 6 weeks. They did 1,430,000 viewers and a 0.35 in the demo. So that was down 27% from last week. Men in the demo were down 30% this past week. But all that said, summertime, it's WWE's for the taking, as they are commanding these Friday nights.
They beat the NFL.
They beat the NFL. Don't give me this talk about NFL being bigger than the WWE, okay?
SmackDown number one, NFL number two.
Confirmed, yeah. The preseason doesn't hold a candle to SmackDown, even without John Cena and Cody Rhodes on the show. So
it is true that SmackDown USA had a 0.35 PT-49 rating. Titans versus Falcons on the NFL Network, which I don't think has quite as broad coverage of households as USA Network does, but nonetheless, did a 0.29 PT-49 rating preseason game.
Then we have Collision the next night. Was a show that did 286,000 viewers and a 0.06. So this was a...
Not great.
Saturday, no, not great. This was their lowest audience since March the 1st. They were up against the vaunted NFL preseason. They were up against a Major League Baseball game and the UFC 319 prelims.
Yes.
So I think we found even more counter-programming for AEW here in the TKO family with these prelims from the weekend. This was a big drop, 32% in viewership from the prior Saturday night, and dropping to a 0.06, their lowest in several weeks as well. This was one where male viewership was kind of down significantly across the board, and it was just however you want to get to that. Like Collision sometimes can be very inconsistent in these Saturday night charts, and
if you look at the
quarters, more susceptible to what else is on as well when it's not kind of your necessarily destination show of the week.
Briefly look at the quarters, that the trend was odd to the point it makes me wonder if they had a weaker lead-in than usual. They just started off at a much lower beginning audience than they normally do for this week's Collision.
And then Raw on Netflix from a week ago Monday. So this was the week after the SummerSlam show. It ended up slightly down at 2.8 million views globally, which was still their second highest since June the 9th behind last week's show following SummerSlam, 5.3 million hours viewed. It was seventh globally in the top 10 rankings, ranking sixth in the U.S., ninth in Canada among the 17 countries where it ranked. So that was Raw for the week. And those are your ratings notes. We have a super chat here, Brandon.
We do. Let's tackle it.
All right. Volcano eruption. Thank you for the super chat. Do you have any thoughts on Dave Meltzer's breakdown of Raw getting less viewership than Dynamite?
So here's how much viewership I think Raw is getting. So I'm estimating this based on what we know about the big premiere, and I'm just
and this would be U.S. viewership, correct?
This is my estimate of total U.S. viewership, based on how much it has declined from the first episode, which we do have a U.S. household number for, which I've just extrapolated the 1.37. As we all know, 1.37 people per household watch wrestling. It's been a pretty consistent figure on USA Network over the last several years. So I think they're doing somewhere around 1.6 million viewers, 1.5 million viewers. If we were to actually get these numbers measured by Nielsen, that's roughly where I would expect them to be, which means they are slightly down from last year. As I mentioned before here, I've spoken at length. Well, I've messaged at length with Dave about how to interpret the vaunted Raw Netflix data. Dealing with Raw on Netflix is unusual, not only because we're dealing with a global number, but because we're dealing with a program that has multiple durations depending on when you watch it. Why does that matter? Because this global views number that we look at is calculated simply based on dividing the hours watched, just the total number of hours that people across the globe have spent watching this show through 7 days, and then you divide that by the duration of the program, and that's how Netflix compares these programs in their chart. But again, most programs have a consistent single duration, right? It's, you know, the season of Wednesday is 5 hours long or something, whatever it is. But Raw, which I understand when it's live, is about 2.5 hours every week now, right?
Pretty much always 2.5 hours, give or take the odd time. It may go a little longer, but yeah, two and a half.
But by the time you watch it and turn it on Netflix the next day, it's much shorter because they've eliminated the commercials and everybody's on a different tier, whether they're on the ad tier or what have you. So
they usually list a time on these charts of about roughly like 40 minutes less than the live viewing.
And it's different every week. So I did ask Netflix about this way back in February, and they explained to me that they use a blended, and I wrote about this at the time, that they use a blended views calculation, so that there are, in the example that they gave me, which was not a real example, but it was a hypothetical example, in the example that they gave me, they showed me they have four different durations, and then it all comes out, it all reconciles, which, you know, in Netflix's representation of it, they're not cooking the books here. Now, I understand the math that Dave is doing. He's supposing that the duration that ends up in the Tudum chart is the lowest possible duration, because presumably it's removing all of the commercials, and you can't get lower than that, right? I don't know what we should do. What I've thought about doing is, like, I need to record Raw and I need to timestamp all the ads and actually subtract that time out to see what is the lowest possible duration of Raw. If you're able to get a lower duration that is than what is on the Tudum chart, you can make this make sense.
Okay. Yeah.
Does that make sense for people?
Probably
not. Does that solve the controversy?
No, but I think that's what it comes down to, because I think there is that discrepancy about the length of the show and how they arrive at the various things. They're not just using that one lowest length. They're looking at a multiple series of shows to account for
it's really counterintuitive and math intensive. Like, you would think that the longer the duration is, the more that would help the show, but it's really not. It doesn't help the final number. To get a larger global views number, it helps to have a shorter duration. It's something that I should do, and I've thought about doing this. Is like, I should find a way to live record Netflix's live broadcast of Raw and then timestamp each of the ad breaks and then mathematically subtract that out, and we would get a better idea. We could also ask Netflix about this as well.
But would this make you have to sit down and watch Raw live from start to finish?
That is the issue there. We'll have some meetings about that. I would have to get the password to my Netflix account too, which is another obstacle.
Because I'd offer to help you, but I don't watch Raw live, and I've got to talk about it right afterwards. So, I mean, that's a tough ask. Not so much a question, but Jared says that these low ratings on Saturday are the reason AEW Collision should move to Thursdays from now on. I mean, in a bubble, that seems like a meaningful move. But, I mean, we've seen many examples of Collision airing on Thursday, and it's like the 2 weeks ago number on Thursday was actually lower than last week's Saturday night number. It's like the Thursday, it makes sense for other reasons, from just a scheduling side of things for AEW and being on the road. But in terms of the numbers, it's not like we have this giant discrepancy between Thursday and Saturday, that they are like, I think a lot of Collision, like, it's not going to be like, if you are the consumer of AEW and you're going to watch all 4 hours every week, great. But there's a lot of people who, like, Collision is definitely going to be their second priority of AEW. And it's going to be a show that sometimes comes at the whim of what other things are going on a Saturday night. And it's, some weeks are more important than others that you're going to see this infrequency. And Thursdays, I don't think it changes that. Like, it's still not going to be this 1A, 1B to Dynamite.
I think, you know, if all other things are equal, if he had, you know, freedom to put it wherever, I think Thursday would be better, just because it's away from the Saturday shows and the WWE shows that are going to inevitably impact it. It might be away from some sports competition, even though if you move to Thursday, you are going against an NFL game during an NFL season. Although you are going against the least strong primetime weekly game. And you might not even have an impact to worry about on Thursdays soon either.
That's right. And we didn't talk about Forbidden Door, but they are in Europe now. They're doing today's show is happening, I think, as we speak in Glasgow. And Forbidden Door on Sunday, WrestleTix has it at 17,159 at the O2 Arena. So they will be sold out by the time this show takes place. They're right near full for the show, which is going to be among the higher gates in AEW's history. So it is the, you know, continued success of this Forbidden Door concept, even with one that has, you know, less involvement than past years of other promotions.
Yes, the things that were behind the Forbidden Door are now in the main corridor.
That's right. I mean, everyone has a key at this point. Everyone's got, you know, 24-hour access to inside the Forbidden Room. All right. You know what? I'm going to throw in this other question because it was emailed to us, and we will give some priority to someone that went out of their way to email us. This was from Andy, who asked me and Brandon, do you think that ESPN made such a strong bid for WWE PLE rights because they already knew they would be losing the UFC rights? I don't think it's the case, but maybe you think
differently. If you take Mark Shapiro and Ari Emanuel at their word, they weren't set on giving everything exclusively to Paramount until the last few days.
Yes. Once the merger was complete.
Yeah.
Which has raised eyebrows among some of how they pulled something like that off so quickly.
Is this an Ari Emanuel conspiracy?
There are conspiracy theories out there when it comes to all of this coming together. But I think in a perfect world, I think ESPN, they were not going to overbid. They're not going to overbid for any rights, whether it's Major League Baseball, whether it's UFC rights. But I think ESPN would have been happy to stay and have both WWE and UFC, but they were not going to outbid Paramount and Skydance when they came in, like, just well above what the other suitors were willing to bid on those rights. So I think that it's, you know, we did kind of see this several rights deals ago when, you know, Fox kind of got out of the UFC business and then got into the WWE business. And now they're removed from both. But I think in this case, I think if ESPN, who are, by the way, launching their streaming service today, I think if they could have had both at a reasonable price, they would have retained both. I don't think it was a case of just trading in one for the other.
I mean, the Paramount deal, I mean, this is sort of like the SmackDown deal in that after the fact, you can tell yourself a story about what contributed to this. And we know that there were tech issues oftentimes with ESPN Plus, right? And it's really attractive to be able to get in front of the pay-per-view wall as long as they're making you at least whole financially, which, you know, they got their rights more than doubled. So it sounds like they got a pretty good financial deal out of it. And you're getting the benefit of putting your most highly anticipated product in front of a much bigger audience than ever.
That's Mark Shapiro's argument. It's not Dana White's.
That's right. The pay-per-view business is still alive.
All right. And yeah, we also had that note in the Wall Street Journal profile that Mark Shapiro would make a great chairman at Disney to succeed Bob Iger.
A unified platform, more personalization, more customization.
All I can say to that is I don't want to see Mark Shapiro leave us for Disney. Okay, that would drastically reduce my level of engagement with TKO and some.
Well, he's in charge of ESPN, right? So it would. It's not out of the realm of possibility.
Oh, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility at all. That I'm sure this guy has his sights set very, very, very high. Yeah. All right. Well, there you go, everyone. We're going to bring this show to a close, but thanks to everyone for tuning in live, for the super chats, for the emails, for people tracking us down. We always appreciate it. We're here every Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern time. And for more to break down the numbers, see his wonderful charts, you can go to patreon.com/WrestleNomics or WrestleNomics.substack.com. A lot of great stuff up over the last couple of days, including Brandon dissecting the Japanese wrestling industry for everyone's enjoyment.
Yes, all that's there.
You want to bring up just tap out attendance figures? Now you are armed for that next debate.
If you want to know how many people are attending just tap out shows, and if you're not satisfied with what we showed you today, you can look at it more closely for yourself at patreon.com/WrestleNomics.
Yeah, you can also email him if you're a Dragon Gate fan and dispute Brandon's characterization of Dragon Gate possibly inflating its attendance numbers as well. You can find my work over at postwrestling.com. Tonight, I will be live with Way after AEW Dynamite from Scotland as they are heading into Forbidden Door. And then on Thursday, we're dropping a new Rewind Away at postwrestlingcafe.com covering the 2001 King of the Ring as Kurt Angle takes on Shane McMahon. We're going to talk about the extreme wrestling bill that was passed in 2000 in the state of New Jersey and how Shane McMahon and Kurt Angle welcomed in that extreme wrestling bill, which magically didn't apply to WWF nor the then thriving companies of ECW or WCW. So that will be on display on Thursday on Rewind Away. That is it for us. We want to thank everyone for joining us, and we will speak with you next Wednesday.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.